This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, we dedicate the entire program to Black Agenda Report's 8th anniversary celebration, held at historic Riverside Church in New York City. The evening was focused on the significance of Ferguson, Missouri, and the Black Liberation Movement. I had the honor of being one of the first speakers.
Most of the folks that I know are working on the proposition, or maybe it's not a proposition, it's a hope, that Ferguson, Missouri, what's happened there, may signal an important historical juncture for Black people in the United States. And I think that there's very good reason to believe that that is the case. And I know that if we behave and if we work and if we discipline ourselves, then this can really become the kind of pivotal time in history that many of us have been working towards for a very, very long time. What makes Ferguson important is that the people refused to stand down when they were confronted with the raw, intimidating power of a Gestapo-like police, a militarized police. They stood their ground. Michael Brown's murder was nothing out of the ordinary. It was an ordinary event in this horror show called the United States. The horror is in the ordinariness of Michael Brown's murder, in the everydayness of it, in the business as usualness of his murder. But the people of Ferguson's response was something out of the ordinary. And that's why we are speaking in terms of Ferguson being some kind of pivotal point today. They're the ones who created the focal point of rage. And they created the political space. And they created the political opportunity for the nation and the world to take notice and for people who are activists to get busy. They're the ones who said, come, look at this barbaric murder. You've got to respond to this. You are summoned. You are compelled to come here and deal with this. The people of Ferguson showed that they were ready for struggle, that they were prepared to stand up to the police, to stand up to the armed state. And so it was a challenge, in fact, to us. Many of us thought that it could not happen, but the people of Ferguson challenged us. Since nobody thinks that the people of Ferguson, Missouri are all that different from Black folks anywhere else in this country, that means that our folks in general may be ready to engage in organized resistance to this mass Black incarceration state after 40 years of being under its boot. And that is something that is historically very significant. Some of us are wishful enough to think that Ferguson signals an end to the self-imposed passivity and the quietude that has characterized Black America in the age of Obama, which is now 6 years in and running. Obama, however, is on his way out. And that means a lot more than the fact that there will not be this Black icon in the White House. He goes out having demonstrably done nothing of substance for Black America. And in fact, he has presided over an unmitigated economic and social disaster that has itself resulted in so many Black bodies in the streets and with cops looking like and behaving like U.S. Marines in Fallujah. That is the Obama legacy. There's a large segment of our people, and by large I mean enough of them to make a movement or the beginnings of one. A large segment of our people have concluded that it's time to go back to the streets. That's part of what makes this an historic and pivotal moment. But we will not do right by the people. We will not seize this watershed moment if we are not armed with a proper analysis of where we are. If we don't do it scientifically, as Brother Yeshua Taylor was speaking, if we don't apply all of the lessons that we have learned, and I don't mean as individuals, but collectively in this long struggle that we've been engaged in the United States. There is a general understanding, certainly in the wake of Ferguson, that the police act as an occupying army in Black America. But the Black Panther Party and others were saying that 45 years ago. And two generations have passed since much of Black America and its allies came to that conclusion. This is old news. Yet we have gone from just one SWAT team in the country back in 1969, and that was in Los Angeles, to a whole nation of SWAT teams. There are 80,000 SWAT team raids a year in the United States. That is how far we have fallen, and we have not made the required noise and motion to stop that kind of velocity. The question is, what happened in the 45 years between 1969, when the Los Angeles headquarters of the Black Panther Party was raided by that first SWAT team? What happened between then and now, 2014? The militarization of the police grew by leaps and bounds. The black prison population grew probably tenfold since that time. But active resistance to the black mass incarceration state and to police militarization has not been up front and center in the black American political conversation during that period, even though those are the most important things that were happening to us. Instead, black people have been told to be most concerned about the upward mobility of a small segment of our society, the most fortunate segment of black society. Who's been leading that conversation? Who has misdirected our people's concentration away from the two greatest challenges that face us? And those two challenges are mass black incarceration and gentrification, which is closing the window on black majority cities and even large plurality black cities all across the country. The who is the black misleadership class. We, I think, coined that term here at Black Agenda Report. This is the class that profits from the massive state repression that shut down and murdered and threw into prison the voices that told us back in 67 and 68 and 69 that the police were an occupying army and that they need to be ejected from our communities. This was the class that counseled black folks in the early 70s that mass movement politics was passé and that liberation came from voting the straight Democratic Party ticket, and that independent black politics and radical politics in general was an unsophisticated approach to power. And of course, none of us wanted to be unsophisticated. What I maintain, and I think this is shared by most of us, if not all of us at Black Agenda Report, is that the internal struggle, especially at this stage of the game, is a primary struggle. That we understand, many of us, the dimensions of this capitalist state under conditions of decay and what it is willing to do to us. What we do not have clear in our heads, and I'm talking when I say our, I mean activists. What is not clear in our heads is how we deal with this black misleadership class, which acts in collaboration with those powers that be, that voted 80% of them, I'm talking about the Congressional Black Caucus now, 80% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to continue Pentagon transfers of weapons and military gear to local police. 4 out of 5. And this is representative of the collaboration of this class. We have to come to grips with how we isolate and replace them in terms of leadership in Black America, or else we will not have seized the time. Thank you.
In addition to Black Agenda Report's editors and columnists, the anniversary celebration featured honored guests Lynn Stewart, the people's lawyer and former political prisoner, and Omali Yeshitela, the veteran activist and chairman of the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations.
I'm a revolutionary because I've come to the conclusion a long time ago that this thing that we call America and capitalism and imperialism, they have no redeeming qualities at all. What we see is, notwithstanding the success of the United States government, and I mean the United States government crushing this revolutionary movement, notwithstanding the violence that's perpetrated against Africans in this country every day, so that we have this massive number of African people locked up in prisons everywhere, children in prison throughout this country, young men being gunned down on a regular basis, even according to the FBI's own data. Twice a week, a white policeman kills an African in this country. We recognize that in this country, we're talking about a situation where one out of every 8 human beings on earth that's locked up in a prison is a Black person in America. This is the horrible reality that we exist with. And somebody wants to convince us that Barack Hussein Obama represents a new development, some kind of progress of the struggle of our people. It is nonsense. And the fact of the matter is that, like Al Sharpton, Obama is not an example of the success of our movement. He is a consequence of the defeat of our revolution. He is a consequence of the defeat of our revolution. Malcolm X had to die before Obama could emerge. Martin Luther King had to die before Obama could march throughout this country and not even mention African people unless it was in some kind of condemnatory fashion. He represents defeat. And so some people have been extraordinarily disillusioned. But if you look around the world, we saw Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and the people there defy U.S. imperialism. If you look around the world, we see it happening with Evo Morales in Bolivia and Ecuador and other places. The people are rising up. We see the tenacity of the people in Palestine fighting against this vicious white nationalist military outpost of U.S. imperialism. And even though there hasn't been a direct connection to the revolution by young people in this country, they have had to absorb the lessons being taught by the people in Afghanistan, by the people in Iraq, by the people in Palestine and every place else in the world. And they've seen that this U.S. imperialism, this mighty U.S. is not so mighty after all. That the people can fight against them and the people can win. And people went into Ferguson. And Ferguson was magnificent also because we saw, we are seeing the collapse of a hegemony of a sector of our population that has been able to control what appears to be a movement now for the last 2 generations. And we see a new militancy arising from a base of people who have been struggling now on the ground every day. They have become battle season, fighting tear gas and rubber bullets, dodging police, going to jail and what have you, and they're not tolerating Al Sharpton and the imams and the rabbis or the Black preachers from a variety of denominations to stand up on a platform in front of 3,000 people and act as if though they are representing the masses. The people intervene, and we are going to see more and more intervention in the days and weeks to come. The revolution is being reborn even as we stand here, even as we sit here today.
Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the Black Is Back Coalition.
People's lawyer Lynn Stewart spent more than 2 years in prison for the crime of zealously defending her client. The whole time, Ms. Stewart was suffering from stage 4 cancer. She was let out on New Year's Day last year on compassionate medical release, and Black Agenda Report was honored by her presence at Riverside Church.
My side of the 60s, my side of the 70s was to be with the militants, and I can't tell you how my heart sang when we got a call from Dequi that said Koo will probably be released the end of November. And that coming on top of Sundiata. And that decision, now we have to make them eat it. They made the decision, now live up to it. Let them go. You said it, let them go home.
It
is the ice beginning to crack? I sure hope so, because I know I dedicated the rest of my life to fighting for prisoners, and particularly political prisoners. I told the women at Carswell, and they said, what should we do? Then you're going to be gone. We can't. But that. I said, listen, the one thing, never give up. Fight, fight, fight. And because, as I said, I spent the whole day in the hospital and I'm holding on to the lectern for dear life here, I'm going to close by reading an RSVP that was sent by a young man at that time named Terry Bisson. Terry was a part of the now defunct May 19th organization, but so many of their members are active and busy, and Terry is. Terry writes. Terry writes the most wonderful science fiction, the most wonderful fantasy, but he wrote this back at a time when the feds had really decimated the movement. And by that I mean they got an informant named Sam Brown. They broke his neck in prison. They broke his neck while other people, who I will remain nameless from this podium, but if anybody wants to know the name of the lawyer for that yet man, I'm happy to share it because I don't think we should keep things like that secret. But Sam Brown's neck was broken, and Sam Brown gave up the entire family, everybody, every place, everywhere. And everybody got locked up. And then they locked up 25 people on the basis of a grand jury subpoena. Well, Terry was one of the people who received a grand jury subpoena, and he wrote an answer to the FBI. And it's so good that I just thought I had to repeat it, because I think we're going to enter into an era where our resistance is going to be all important. We cannot relax. We cannot say, oh, well, Snowden says they heard everything we said. Oh, well, you know, we can go forward. We have to show resistance constantly, because otherwise they will run right over the top. But we should always be aware of who they are, who we are. And I'm going to read you Terry's RSVP to the FBI. I'm being subpoenaed to give information to a federal grand jury investigating revolutionary movements inside the USA. Thank you for handing me this invitation to talk to you, but I am otherwise engaged. Thank you for offering me this opportunity to have a heart-to-heart with the murderers of Martin Luther King and Fred Hampton, not to mention Crazy Horse, Michael Stewart, and Eleanor Bumpers, and the nameless millions who do have and will have names. But I am otherwise engaged. Thank you for inviting me to sit down with the brothers of the Somocistas, as you describe yourselves, their long knives eager for the blood of teachers, the blood of nuns, the blood of Sandino, which is right now running like a river in the veins of a young Nicaragua. But I am otherwise engaged. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to spit on the graves of Sacco and Vanzetti, to dishonor the memory of the Rosenbergs or of my ex-father-in-law, who spent 10 years not being an actor rather than 10 minutes being a collaborator. But I am otherwise engaged. Thank you for inviting me to run with the hounds howling through the ruined cities, trying to hunt down the FALN, the BLA, the 10 or the 100 most wanted, most ready and willing and able to resist with arms and heart and ideology your worldwide crimes. But I am otherwise engaged. And seriously, thanks for giving me the chance to stand fast with the Puerto Ricans who have gone to jail silent since 1936 rather than drink from your boot prints, to stand fast with the new Africans who, like Nat Turner, never said a mumbling word, to stand fast with the Palestinians steadfast in Israeli prisons, the Irish deep and defiant in Lankesh, the Africans on Robben Island scorning your offers with songs, to stand fast with the children of Lumumba and Che and Malcolm, not to mention my own children and your own as well. Thank you for this chance to stand not with the defeated, but with the defiant.
People's lawyer, Lynn Stewart. Margaret Kimberly is Black Agenda Report's editor and senior columnist. She's been with the team from its very beginnings at The Black Commentator. Kimberly says Michael Brown's death at the hands of Ferguson policeman Darren Wilson needs to be examined in detail in order to understand America in all its racist wretchedness.
He was walking down the street with a friend, walking in the street instead of on the sidewalk. Cop told him to walk on the sidewalk. They have a physical confrontation. He ended up being shot 6 times, including once in his skull and once in one of his eyes. And as O'Malley pointed out, his body was left in the street for 4 hours. And as we all know, his community rose up, but the powers that make this country the world's biggest jailer don't give up so easily. And the first Black president and attorney general have their positions precisely because they have no intention of rocking the boat or changing the status quo. Now, in the past few days, you may have noticed a change in the reporting on Michael Brown's killing. The New York Times, the Washington Post, other corporate media are now quoting law enforcement sources who've declared there's no evidence to support charging Officer Darren Wilson with any federal civil rights violations. Every article now emphasizes that Brown and Wilson had an altercation through the window of the patrol car, and they all say that Wilson feared for his life. They all act as if this is new information when it isn't, and they ignore that Wilson fired on Brown while Brown fled and that he had stopped when the 2 fatal bullets were fired into his head. These reports are very insidious because they come from law enforcement. We don't know who that is, or rather, I didn't until a couple of days ago. I wrote about these new reports, and I decided to check out the Twitter feeds of one of the reporters from the New York Times named Matt Apuzzo, who said, "Evidence so far doesn't support civil rights charges in Ferguson shooting, but investigation continues." And I replied, "Oh, really? Too bad you didn't at least ask some legal experts rather than depend on law enforcement sources." I didn't expect him to respond, but he did. "Law enforcement DOJ," he said, "not experts, will decide on the charges." And we went back and forth, and he says, "You know, it's lousy, I hate it, but we tried to disclose as much as possible. That info didn't come from Ferguson cops." And he repeats, "Law enforcement DOJ, not experts, will rely on the charges." So he pretty much said that the leaks came from the Department of Justice. Now, Eric Holder went on record and said he's very unhappy about these leaks from the DOJ. And what's his saying? "I think he protests too much." I'm sure that this information is being fed quite deliberately. The narrative has changed from hands up, don't shoot, to Brown had it coming. He deserved it. Their hope is to poison the well of public opinion and dampen expectations from black people that anything resembling justice, which means prosecution of Wilson, will come about. So let me be clear about one thing. The president, like all presidents, prosecutes whenever he wants to. When he decided to kill Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen and his teenage son, he did it. He even sent the attorney general out to tell Americans they were mistaken in their beliefs about due process, and they made up some nonsense about you get judicial process but not due process, some foolishness. But I bring it up to make sure that when Wilson is not indicted and they send Al Sharpton out, that we don't fall for the foolishness. I'm going to repeat. If there's no federal prosecution of Darren Wilson, it will be because the president doesn't want it. There ought to be an organization like Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International that investigates this country, an organization devoted solely to monitoring America's human rights record. When Quadir Felton, a Jersey City teenager, was shot in the head and blinded by a cop, he was charged with assault. And I wonder, does New Jersey have any black elected officials? Because I didn't hear anything about it. But hopefully there will be an international tribunal where Diamond Milburn and Khalif Browder and Quadir Felton can be witnesses. And I imagine some sanction against the United States for its actions and inactions which permit these people and others like them to suffer. When there are rankings of human rights abuses, this country must be at the top of the list.
That was Bar editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, originally from Detroit, now living in Washington, is a whistleblower, author, and activist, and an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. Her last two articles have traced contemporary U.S. police forces to their roots in the slave patrols of Old Dixie.
The slave patrols had three primary goals. One, to chase down, to apprehend, to surveil, and to return to their owners escaped Africans. Two, to provide a form of organized terror, to deter African armed struggle or revolts. And three, to maintain a form of discipline or social control for Africans who were subject to vigilante execution if they violated any plantation rules or just ran afoul of any white person. After the Civil War, these slave patrols became Southern police departments, and these slave patrollers were integrated into Southern police departments. And these Southern police departments had four main goals. One, controlling freed Africans now locked into oppressive sharecropper farming or abusive former terrorist and slaver relationships. Two, enforcement of Jim Crow segregation laws. Three, denial of African human rights. And four, institutional resistance to Africans who attempted to engage in political struggle. So we have, in a sense, a framework here that I think we can look at and we can begin to think about how much of this legacy of slave patrolling is actually influencing modern police practices today. And so I would just like to make a case here, because I would like to suggest that our language, that we need to think about the language we use because it reflects the true nature of our struggle, because it informs our analysis. For example, I'm from Washington, D.C., and we have a lot of discussions about community policing. How would our conversations change, for example, if we were discussing community policing with our local slave patrol units? I'm just asking. Or would it really be a surprise that 92% of all the arrests in Ferguson and 83% of all arrests in Washington, D.C. of black folks were carried out by the 21st century slave patrols? So when will the Miss Leadership class call policing in the black community what it really is? And when will we begin to demand that these communities come under some kind of receivership until the community can develop their own system of civilian protection because we need to get rid of the police in these communities immediately because they are killing our children. Yet every generation finds the courage and resilience to fight back. And this is the power of the resistance taking place in Ferguson. And we have arrived at this point in our history where we don't need to speak in polite terms about the intentional murder of black boys and black men in this country. The only question is, what is the end game for our community? So I will end here with one of my favorite quotes from Alhaj Malik al-Shabazz. And if you know this quote, because I think it's knitted on all of our hearts, please recite it with me. We declare our right on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence. Please join me as I say these last few words. By any means necessary. Thank you.
That was Marsha Coleman Adebayo. Bruce Dixon is managing editor of Black Agenda Report. He lives in Atlanta. At Barr's anniversary celebration, Dixon explained that the black misleadership class is not a new phenomenon. Booker T. Washington paved the way more than a century ago.
Our black political class of preachers, of politicians, of pundits and media people, of professional and business types, have made an historic deal with the devil. It's a deal every bit as short-sighted and every bit as destructive as the deal that Booker T. and his crew made five generations ago in the 1890s. Their deal was that they would get white philanthropy to run black schools and colleges, staffed largely by blacks, which would turn out an industrious and a docile black working class and black yeoman farmers under the leadership of some black professionals and preachers. Out of gratitude and obligation for being those designated leaders, Booker and the boys, and it was 1890-something, so they were all boys, Booker and the boys agreed that there would be no disturbing the economic and social peace for at least a generation or two. And during this time, our great-great-grandparents, they were supposed to be pulling themselves up to respectable prosperity without questioning segregation, which was everywhere, and without agitating about the vote, which had been taken away two generations earlier at the end of Reconstruction, and without combining into labor or farmers' unions to conduct class warfare on their own behalves. The bargain worked fine for Booker and his crew. They became the de facto political leaders of black America. They became the prosperous conduits through which public patronage and private philanthropy flowed. Booker and his boys essentially got what was promised to them and to their class. But of course, the black masses, well, they never did get any land. And what's a yeoman farmer called without land? In America, he's called a sharecropper. In Mexico, he's called a peon. They never also didn't get any relief from segregation. Matter of fact, when relief from segregation finally did come, it was under the leadership of folks generations later who pretty much repudiated Booker's bargain and who were only able to achieve what they did achieve due to international contingencies. I mean, the U.S. looked bad while fighting Nazis and enforcing Jim Crow at home. And it looked bad later on, beating and murdering civil rights workers and suppressing urban rebellions while it was wrestling with the Soviets and the Chinese for influence in Africa and Asia. When you strike a deal with the devil, somebody always pays a big price. Isn't that the way the story goes? Well, Booker's bargain delayed and diverted our struggle for social and economic rights for at least two, maybe three generations. And many people alive today, are still paying the prices for that. Now, it's not like all this time the older heads were doing nothing. Back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, they were filing case after case after case against segregation. But the collective leadership mindset of the 1940s and the 50s black America, and well into the 60s, was one that put our people's number one hope in the decisions of white judges, judicial intervention, and the limited black vote, because, of course, only black folks in the North could vote. Black folks in the South couldn't vote. And so this is where the leadership was in the 40s and 50s. They used to call Thurgood Marshall Mr. Civil Rights. That was also the era, by the way, which defined our people's struggle as a struggle for civil rights, not economic rights, not human rights, civil rights. And that definition was a measure of the deal that the black leadership class of that era struck. But it was only finally in the times and in the places where young people in the 60s and the 70s and to some extent the 50s also, finally disregarded the counsel of the old heads. And they started disrespecting their elders. They started breaking the law. They started sitting in. They started filling the jails. And by the 60s, they started picking up the gun and organizing self-defense. The Voting Rights Act only happened when young SNCC workers ignored the old heads and launched rural organizing projects, when they challenged the white primaries with not another lawsuit, but by conducting their own primaries and sending their own delegation to the 64 Democratic Convention. Now, the agenda of ordinary blacks was advanced only when young activists disregarded the elders. Wonder what that lesson is for today. What do you think? The pioneering young activists of the 60s and 70s, they disregarded their elders, and one of the things that they did when they disregarded their elders is they looked outside the borders of the United States. They looked for allies, and they looked for useful lessons. Some of them began to openly question economic inequality, the fundamental system of capitalism, and America's unending imperial wars. So what we've got today here is we've got a situation where the current black leadership class has a deal. Their deal is that they will not challenge capitalism at all. They will not acknowledge apartheid in Israel at all. They will not question America's imperial wars, and they will not do any kind of solidarity with any force outside the United States. They put, as Dr. Gerald Horn put it, all their eggs in the basket of electing black faces to high places. So what's going to happen after Ferguson? What we are seeing in Ferguson is we're seeing a lot of local action there that openly disrespects the established black leaders. They flew in Sharpton, they flew in Jesse, they parachuted in platoons of preachers and imams to preach to the people in Ferguson and to be the set pieces of media stuff that flows out of Ferguson that makes it look like they're commandeering and capturing this. Because, of course, the black political class is only interested in mobilizations in election years. But remember Gina. And you remember them saying that, yeah, this is the start of a new movement. Then you remember Troy Davis. And they said, this is the start of a new movement. And they said, with Trayvon, yeah, this is the start of a new movement. So when people ask me, is Ferguson the start of a new movement? Hey, you know, I mean, I'm an optimist, okay? I've been in this a long time. You can't be in this a long time and not be an optimist. I would like to see a new movement. I don't know if it's a new movement. It's a new moment. And what's new about it is that young people in some numbers are openly defying the old heads, the old black leadership. And I know as somebody who was on the ground 45 years ago, that's certainly what we did. We didn't respect our elders too much. We really didn't. So there is a possibility there. There is an opening there. And what's going to happen is it's all conditional. It all depends on how many more of them disregard the pleadings of the imams and the preachers and the politicians. And it depends on how many of them are able to take it a step further, are able to take it a step further and begin organizing real and sustained alternatives. And that's where we're not yet. That's not happening.
Bar Managing Editor Bruce Dixon. Ajamu Baraka is the former director and co-founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network and now an editor and columnist at Black Agenda Report. He spoke about Ferguson, human rights, and beyond.
You know, we know, and in my last piece in Bar, we talked about the connection between race and violence as being fundamental, being the centerpiece of the colonial capitalist project in this country and indeed of the West. That it was the conjoining of race and violence that resulted in the hegemony of the West. That violence was used as a systematic weapon in order to destroy people, capture land, and to enslave. It was the genesis of the creation of the West, if you will. So when we hear the analysis that reveals the role of the police in terms of policing the African-American community, that's consistent. It's consistent with the role of these repressive forces. It's consistent with the kind of militarism that we see today globally. Violence is the fundamental weapon that's been used to maintain the hegemony of the West for the last 522 years. So for us, Ferguson is not something that is unique. We understand that Ferguson was fairly ordinary. But what marks Ferguson as different is that for the first time in 15, 20 years, we had a reaction. We had an effective fight back. We had, for whatever historical reasons, a community that said, no more. We're ready to go to the mat. We're ready to go all the way. And that's what they, in fact, did. And when they did that, then the rest of us stood up with them also. That's what makes this situation different. But we've got to put Ferguson in historical context. You know, we've had rebellions that always seem to start when you had a confrontation between the community and the police. We have, you know, historical examples, Detroit, Watts, you know, Miami. And there was always a reaction, there was some reforms, and then the country went forward. But understand this. Today, the kinds of reforms in terms of the Kerner Commission and all of that, many of us argue that that can happen today. We're in a different context, my friends. You see, neoliberalism was a counter-revolutionary movement that emerged in the 1970s. It was a counter to what we were doing in the 1960s and 1970s. It was the objective of capital to save itself, to engage in a new kind of, not new, but to go back to its genesis and to engage in a new kind of economic development that required also the suppressing of the people. It was conjoining both eliminating the government's ability to monitor and control capital with internal repression. But it was a repression that was targeted. You see, capitalism and liberal democracy has this marvelous capacity to embrace democracy, to pretend to be a democracy, because it has the ability to do that because it can engage in selective repression. And the target of that repression was us. Brother O'Malley talked about how the Black Liberation Movement was basically destroyed in the 1970s. It was destroyed at the same time that the foundation was being put in place for the emergence of Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and neoliberalism. In the Black community, we have always experienced and lived the reality of totalitarianism. Our friend Chris Hedges talks about the work of Sheldon Wallen, who talks about inverted totalitarianism as though that's something new. But that's always been a reality in our communities. So today, as the capitalist system is in decline, the kinds of reforms that we saw at one point is no longer going to be an option, that there's going to be an intensification of repression. The question becomes, what kind of politics are we talking about here in this country? When you look at the black community, in material terms, the black community and black labor is basically redundant economically and socially expendable. What does that mean? It means the recipe for genocide. It means that Ferguson takes place in a context in which the ruling class has said to itself and said to the world that basically we're going to maintain our hegemony by any means necessary. We talked about Malcolm. They said basically we're going to shoot our way to maintain our hegemony. And that's why you can't understand Ferguson without connecting Ferguson to what's happening globally. That militarization in Ferguson is the domestic expression of international militarization. That you can't understand Ferguson without understanding what's happening in Syria and Iraq. That basically the military option is now the only option for these folks. This is in the context of austerity, the context of a white working class and so-called middle class that's being hollowed out. It is the context in which basically the immiseration of millions of people are taking place. And what the rulers attempt to do, or going to try to do, is to make that division between what is happening in the black communities and the realities that white workers and the middle class are facing, to try to play on the notion that white folks have a stake in this system, and that if you want to maintain your position, if you want to continue to believe in the American dream, you have to understand that we've got to all pull together, talking about white folks. That's the basis of the subtext, this appeal to white solidarity. That's why the folks in Ferguson now are being reframed in a different kind of way. When you saw those images of people burning the American flag, already you start seeing people backing away from Ferguson. We are in a very dangerous time, my friends. We have before us the responsibility to have a new kind of vision. We talk about what is the end game. Well, the end game is transformation. We've got to continue to believe in the possibility of the people being able to transform themselves and transform these conditions. We've got to believe in the possibility of us winning. When we talk about the end game, we're talking about revolutionary change. That's still on the table. So the only challenge we have is, how do we get there?
That was veteran activist and bar editor and columnist Ajamu Baraka. Dr. Anthony Montero is a renowned scholar, an expert on the works of W.E.B. Du Bois, and a great friend of Black Agenda Report. He offered a long view of the meaning of Ferguson.
I think what we're trying to understand is this period in which we live, where the old is dying, but the new is not yet ready to be born. And it is filled with ambiguities and contradictions. Hopefully, Ferguson will not be a false start, but it will be the beginning of what W.E.B. Du Bois called the dusk of dawn, the end of the dawn and the beginning of the full daylight of resistance and struggle. How do we talk about the murders, especially young men, but also young women in the streets of this country? Again, I'd like to refer to W.E.B. Du Bois, who, when talking about Jack Johnson in the second decade of the 20th century, said that his crime was his unforgivable blackness. He said his blackness was the crime of crimes. And that's what we're looking at. These young men and women are killed and incarcerated because they are black. This means that the incarceration and murder of young black men and women is under international law a high crime of genocide. 1951, as most of you know, William L. Patterson and Paul Robeson petitioned the United Nations, charging the United States government, and that's where the finger must be pointed, the United States government with committing the crime of genocide against African American people. Under international law, genocide is not, and I want to emphasize, is not only or primarily mass extermination, although that is included in it. When you look at the day-to-day conditions under which African Americans live, extreme poverty, lack of education, imprisonment, murder in the streets, and this crime of crimes of the system against the urban working class, gentrification. When you put all of this and more together, what we're looking at is genocide against African American people. Now, of course, the conventions on human rights and so on are very important to appeal to protect African Americans from, quote, our own government. But I think the operative part of international law that we have to appeal to and make popular in the political discourse of our people and a way of linking our struggle and the discourses that we are having politically among ourselves with a global discourse is the appeal to international law and in particular the conventions against genocide. No period like the one we are living in, where the old is dead and dying and the new cannot be born, can be moved forward without an intense, conscious, disciplined, ideological struggle. I think Barr provides us with a venue for that.
Activist and scholar Dr. Anthony Montero. Black Agenda Report's poet in residence is Raymond Nat Turner from Los Angeles, now living in Harlem.
Drawing unemployment is like drawing straws. We come up short under rich folks' laws. Living on nothing while hunger works full time. Living on nothing while hunger works full time. No wonder some brothers stumble into crime. And the rich cry, crime, 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 every day. And the rich cry, crime, 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 every day. While cocaine is being trafficked by the CIA. We've been slaving for the monsters, and what we get, We've been slaving for the monsters, and what we get, stack of papers to fill out asking dumb shit. State here the reason you're out of work. Answer the following, then report to the clerk. Will you accept work in your usual trade? What's your income with benefits paid? Do you own a farm or a ranch? Do you have a savings? What branch? Did you look for work all this past week? Where did you go? With whom did you speak? Are you a citizen of the U.S.? If answered no, then why not yes? Anyone in line who voluntarily quit, step out, go over there and sit. Sorry, you can't be seen until 10, provided you fill this out for when. We've been slaving for the monsters, and what we get. We've been slaving for the monsters, and what we get. Appointment with revolution when we fit.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.